Good morning, everyone. My name is Austin Smith. Welcome to the show Poets Table, where I share with you one of my favorite poets in the hopes that they might become one of your favorite poets. And this morning, I'll be talking about the great American, I say American, but also you could call her an expat poet, Elizabeth Bishop. Elizabeth Bishop was born in Nova Scotia in 1911. She had a very, very difficult childhood. Her father died when she was just a baby, and her mother was seriously mentally ill and was committed to an institution. So Bishop was actually raised by her maternal grandparents and eventually was brought by her wealthier paternal grandparents to Massachusetts. She was a very precocious poet. She started writing poems at a very young age. She became friends and kind of a mentee of an older female poet named Marianne Moore, who kind of took Bishop under her wing. So Elizabeth Bishop spent some time in New York City. She then traveled extensively in Europe. She would become one of the great writers of travel poetry, I think, in American poetry. Many of her poems, because of her kind of peripatetic lifestyle, take place abroad, in places like Brazil, where she lived for many years, as well as some time that she spent in Europe as well. So she grew up kind of all over the place, and it was actually very coincidental that she landed in the country of Brazil. She was there's an anecdote that she was on a ship. She was extraordinarily allergic to cashew nuts, and she happened to eat a cashew and had a terrible allergic reaction, and it basically forced her to spend some time kind of resting and recovering in Brazil, where she met an architect named Lota de Macedo Soares. And Bishop, being a lesbian poet, spent basically 14 years of her life living with this female architect in Brazil. And they built a house together there. They had a whole life in Brazil together. And tragically, Soares committed suicide in 1967. And Bishop had to leave Brazil. And she spent kind of the latter part of her life living in New York and San Francisco and in Massachusetts, kind of teaching wherever she could find teaching work. She was not a very prolific poet in that she didn't publish a lot of collections. She wrote very slowly, and her very good friend, the poet Robert Lowell, recalled seeing unfinished poems on the refrigerator at Bishop's apartment, poems that were very close to being finished, but Bishop was waiting for the right word, and so there would be like a blank line or a blank where there should have been a word, and she was just waiting for the right word to come to her, and she would sometimes wait for years before she declared a poem finished. So she worked very slowly, and though she ultimately did write a lot of poems in her lifetime, only a handful of collections were published. But she became kind of a poet's poet. In other words, other poets adored her work and kind of waited with bated breath for her collections to come out. And she wrote, as I said, a lot about travel, a lot about displacement, a lot about loss. And I'm going to share with you today probably two poems by Bishop, the first being her most famous poem called One Art, and the second being another quite famous, but maybe not quite as famous poem, At the Fish Houses. And I think that these two poems will give you a sense for her style. She had a, you might say, a kind of conversational tone in her work, which I really appreciate. It's easy to dismiss her as being almost a prosaic poet. She's very accessible. I think this is one of the reasons that she has become so popular since her death. She is a poet who can kind of be deceptively simple on the page, but I feel that her work begs rereading and revisiting. And She was a very complicated figure. She also wrote fiction. She's a very prolific letter writer. There are some amazing collections of letters, particularly a collection of letters that she exchanged with the poet I mentioned before, Robert Lowell. They had a very, very close friendship. And there was something about her that has kind of, she's become almost like a cult figure in not only in American poetry, but I think in literature generally. There's a, good morning, everyone. I'm Austin Smith, and this is Poets Table. As always, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. I have to start off with some disappointing news. This is going to be the last episode of Poets Table, at least for a while. I've decided to return to teaching poetry and fiction out at Stanford University, and so I need to move back west in the coming weeks to get ready for the new school year. So I'm going to have to put the show on hold at least for a while. I do anticipate returning to the Driftless, and so I don't think that this is any final goodbye, but I'm gonna have to stop making the show at least for a while. And I just wanted to say from the bottom of my heart how deeply thankful I am for the opportunity to have hosted the show these last weeks. And for all of you who have been listening, and to those of you who've written to me, thank you so much for listening to the show, and I'm so glad that it's resonating with people. It's been a great pleasure for me to be able to share some of my favorite poets and some of my favorite poems with listeners of WDRT. I've really missed teaching, which is why I'm returning to teaching, but hosting this show has allowed me to kind of do what I do in the classroom, which is to share work that I really resonate with and love, and then try to express why I resonate with and love it. So this has just been a really, really valuable opportunity for me. And I want to thank again everyone for listening and for all of the support of WDRT and its listeners. And again, I hope that this is not a final goodbye because I've really, really deeply enjoyed this experience. It's helped me to especially right now, you know, with the election so recently, to take a little bit of a pause and kind of settle into some of my favorite poets' work and sit with their poems and try to think through what it is about these poems that have kind of resonated with me so deeply that I can't seem to slough them off or forget them. You know, I'm accompanied by these poems in my life in a way that is I think a blessing. And so if even one poem that I've shared with you accompanies you in the coming days and years, then I think that this has been a very successful experience. And so, all that aside, I thought that for the last show, again, at least for now, I would do something a little different and talk a little bit about my own work and share some of my own poems. It's a little bit atypical of me as a humble Midwesterner to do this. I've really tried to focus the show on other poets, and not talk so much about my own work. But I think, you know, even in talking about other poets, I'm in a way talking about my own work because I wouldn't share these poets were they not so significant to me in my own thinking about poetry and my own writing. And I think without question, my favorite episode was the episode in which I had the opportunity to sit down with my dad, Daniel Smith, and talk to him about his poems, which are collected in a beautiful collection called Ancestral. And if you listen to that episode, you know that I was very fortunate to be able to grow up in a household where poetry was loved and valued, and to grow up going to my dad's poetry readings and read his poems, to meet poets who would come to visit my dad, and to see how one weds their writing life with their work life. And I know that's been really significant for me as a teacher. You know, I'm, of course, first and foremost, I guess, a poet, but I also think that my teaching has really imbued my own poetic process with great, great amount of value and richness. And so this is all kind of to say that poetry, I've always felt, is a lifestyle more than just a genre, and it's really a way of being in the world. So I've tried to embody that in my life and in my work, and it's definitely thanks to how I was born and raised. And I've had the opportunity also as a poet to work with many great teachers in graduate school particularly. And there's just something really beautiful about kind of the apprenticeship that happens when you're a younger poet coming up and working on your first book and trying to get a manuscript published. And it can be disappointing and challenging, of course, but there's something really beautiful about it as well. And I've been fortunate to be able to publish two collections of poetry. The first one is called Almanac, and I published it back in 2014 or so. The second one is called Flyover Country, and I published that one about 4 years ago in tw 2018. So I should be due for another one pretty soon if I'm on a 4-year cycle, kind of like an election cycle, I guess. But I definitely feel very, very fortunate to have published these two collections. And I haven't talked too much about poetry collections. I focused more on individual poets and their individual poems, but every poetry collection has a different feel to it. It's sort of its own. It's you could think of it almost like a novel, in that it has a kind of narrative thread running through it usually. It comes usually from a particular period in the poet's life. And so poets come out with collections, I think, in these sorts of, they kind of are almost like photographs of the psyche. And so my first book, Almanac, was a book from, earlier in my life as a poet, and a lot of those poems came out of my time in graduate school. And I don't know if I really quite knew what it was I was trying to do. I think I was sort of finding my way, and I just gathered the strongest work together and was fortunate enough to have that book published. But my second book, Flyover Country, I went into it with much more of a sense of what I wanted to try to say. And you can hear, I think, in the title, Flyover Country, that phrase that, grates on us as Midwesterners, and this sort of condescending idea of the Midwest as flyover country. I really wanted to take that phrase, which has always bothered me, and kind of complicate it and use it in a different way, and maybe explore some of its other meanings and deeper resonances. So this collection, Flyover Country, is very much about the Midwest, but there are also lots of poems in the book that have to do with American foreign policy. I was thinking a lot about drone strikes and American wars of aggression abroad and our response to acts of terrorism being kind of acts of terrorism in and of themselves. So I was definitely thinking very politically when I wrote this book. And so it has kind of two threads running through it. There's the thread that is more focused on the Midwest, and there is the thread that's more focused on American foreign policy. And then there are poems in which these two threads are kind of woven together. So I thought I would start with a poem that actually starts off feeling very much like a typical Midwestern poem from a Midwestern childhood, and then kind of at some point, I think, swerves and becomes more of that sort of political poem that I was describing earlier. And just to preface this poem, which is called Cat Moving Kittens, I definitely feel deeply connected to something that the poet Robert Frost said, which is that if the poet isn't surprised, the reader won't be. And this poem really surprised me. I started off writing, I thought about one thing, and it ended up being that I was writing about something very different. And that's probably why I like the poem and why I want to share it with you and why it's included in the collection. I'm not very interested in the poems that I kind of know where they're headed and then they reach that place and they don't really surprise me. I'm more interested in the poems where, I might have started off heading in one direction and found myself taken in a very different direction. So it's really kind of hard to say how that happens. I don't think it's the kind of thing where I can force it. I think it kind of takes a kind of relaxing of intention and willpower, actually. So kind of an abandonment of control, something that's a little difficult to do when you sit down to write. You know, oftentimes you feel like you want to hone in on something in particular, or you have something in particular you want to convey. But as I always try to teach my students, it oftentimes works best to let oneself drift a little bit and be taken in various directions. And that's what happened with this one. So I would love to figure out like how exactly this works so that I can do it more often. But again, it's just something that happens in some poems and not in others, where we surprise ourselves, and those again are the ones that feel like a little bit more magical and interesting to me as a poet. So again, this poem is called Cat Moving Kittens. I'll read it and then I'll just talk about it again a little bit afterwards. Cat Moving Kittens. We must have known, even as we reached down to touch them, where we'd found them, shut-eyed and trembling, under a straw bale in the haymow, that she would move them that night under cover of darkness, and that, by finding them, we were making certain we wouldn't see them again, until we saw them, crouching under the pickup like sullen teens, having gone as wild by then as they'd gone still in her mouth. That night she made a decision any mother might make upon guessing the intentions of the state, to go and to go now, taking everything you love between your teeth. I probably wrote this poem shortly after Trump was elected. It has a different resonance even now with our fears about democracy, and maybe some of those fears have been abated slightly since the election on Tuesday. Knocking on wood here, because I think it's still on our minds, and it's still a very real danger. This idea that there may be something coming that is bigger and larger than ourselves, and therefore requires us to make decisions that we that might be difficult. And I tried to focus all of this into the metaphor of kids looking for a litter of kittens in the haymow, which when I was little was not, I didn't think of it as being a very dark situation or scene, right? Just looking for kittens is something that farm kids do. And yet, as I've gotten older and looked back upon that experience, and thought more about that mother cat and her fear for her litter, and not knowing the intentions of these boys coming to look for the kittens in the haymow, and having therefore to move them and try to hide them in a different place, you know, that's a very real fear that she must have had. And so, in a strange way, the poem becomes about this very kind of innocent, idyllic scene turning darker. And I think, in general, that's what the poem is sort of suggesting, that we might be living in this sort of idyllic moment that could very suddenly change. And we may find that we have to take everything we love between our teeth, not literally as the cat does, but kind of take everything that we love by the skin of its neck and carry it elsewhere, or move things around in our lives in such a way that they are protected and safe. So it's, again, as I said before, I read the poem. I did not anticipate the poem moving in this direction. I was just writing about looking for kittens in the haymow, I thought. And yet, via that experience, I think I arrived at something a little darker and a little bit scarier, and maybe something that I don't feel like I have a grasp on really as a poet or as a citizen. And so this poem, to me, is, if I could say this about my own work, I think it's successful in that it brings us to a place of not knowing and of uncertainty. And I like it when poems do that personally. The next poem I'll share with you, I think I'll share a poem that I wrote when I was traveling. I was traveling abroad. I was actually in Spain, and I was able to go over there for a little bit to work on some writing. And I was in Barcelona, and I was walking down the street late at night, and I saw something that was to me very reminiscent of something I might see, you know, leaving a high school football game in the Midwest. Something that felt universal and therefore made me feel like it didn't really matter that I was in Spain, that I could be pretty much anywhere. So I'll read this poem and then again, I'll talk a little bit more about it afterwards. It's called Father and Son, Barcelona. One day, many years from now, after your father has failed to remember your name, you will only faintly remember this night he carried you home through the streets of the Gothic Quarter, your ash-colored lashes closing and fluttering open, closing and fluttering open, and the faint scent of lather on his neck. Unfair that I, a stranger, will remember him carrying you, while he will die and not remember, and you will live only faintly remembering. But to be alive is to be carried by your father through your city and laid in your bed without waking, then opening your eyes in the morning. So this experience of seeing this father carrying his tired son home just really resonated with me. It felt, again, like something that I could have seen anywhere. And I think we all know from when we're traveling that there's this feeling of discombobulation of not knowing where one is, especially with, you know, if you've just arrived in a place and their time zones are different and you haven't adjusted, and you're in a place where a different language is being spoken, and it's a different culture entirely. I feel like we can oftentimes feel very disoriented, but it was this moment where I felt, you know, I was just watching a father carrying his son home late at night, and again, that's something that I've seen. You know, when I was a kid walking back to the car after a football game, you know, watching fathers carry their tired sons or daughters back to the car. And so it's just this moment of feeling like I was part of a larger human family. And I wanted to express that or dramatize that in the poem. And I hope I did that successfully. I think I'm just going to share these poems once. Rather than reread them. So I'll try to read them slowly and carefully so that you can listen to them. I think I'll re read a poem because we're coming up on deer season here, or we're already in deer season, about a bar in a town called Hyde, Wisconsin, which is down towards where my parents live near Spring Green. And Hyde, spelled Hyde, is actually not much of a town. There's pretty much just a bar there, and that's sort of like the main that's the main attraction. And this poem happened in the fall of a previous year when I walked in there to this tavern, and it was hunting season. And this is not meant to be an anti-hunting poem, by the way. This is just a feeling that the feeling I had when I walked into this bar full of deer hunters in November, probably. So it's called The Only Tavern in Hyde, Wisconsin. When I walked into the forest of camouflage, faces turned, gleaming through the leaves like tin plates hung amongst trees for targets. In a moment of silence, the eyes darted bird-like, measuring what had wandered in. Then the forest broke apart into forms, voices. Hands emerged holding bottles. Bodies lumbered toward the bar, wreathed by smoke, like a forest restless with fire. And the tree-sized men turned back to their game of euchre, torsos thick as trunks, arms the breadth of branches, fingers splayed twig-like, holding their cards like leaves, which they turned as if acting out autumn. And then I noticed on every wall the heads of deer, their glass eyes staring through years of dust at the men who had killed them. So it was just this experience of walking into this bar and this almost like optical illusion of everyone wearing camouflage. And, you know, I kind of harp it, you know, in the poem, it's kind of, a little exaggerated, I guess, it really is exaggerated. The way I describe these men is looking almost like they compose a forest. But I'll never forget that feeling, you know, and there was probably some blaze orange in there too, but mostly just men in camouflage at a bar and the kind of disorientation of, you know, seeing them almost as the forest itself that they had just been hunting in, and sort of turning towards me. I wasn't wearing camo, I wasn't wearing blaze orange, and I probably stood out like a sore thumb in that place, and just being regarded almost by the forest itself. And then the deer on the wall, and they're up there, they're taxidermied and mounted, and that just whole Wisconsin scene was just extremely memorable to me, and I wanted to set it down here in the most vivid way I could. And again, it's sort of a celebration, I think. It's not a not a in no way is it a judgment about hunting. It's more of a feeling that there's a kind of community here between the men who are hunters and the deer who they killed. And this bar is kind of an ecosystem in which they're all kind of one. And I was probably the sole figure that wasn't really part of that world. And maybe that's a metaphor for the poet, coming into a place and being outside of it enough to be able to write about it and observe it. And so it's probably necessary in a sense for the poet to be a little bit apart from the world that they're writing about sometimes, or else we wouldn't have this perspective. So that's what comes to mind when I think about writing this poem, The Only Tavern in Hyde, Wisconsin. I'll read another poem about creatures, and this is a poem I wrote thinking a little bit about how human beings treat one another compared to how we treat animals. And unfortunately, I think sometimes we can have more compassion for animals than we can have for one another, especially people who might not come from our culture, or we might not share a language with. And this is a poem kind of about, I think I wrote it thinking a little bit about the refugee crisis and some of our attitudes regarding the southern border. And but again, I don't want my poems to ever be didactic or to feel like they're trying to prove or to argue anything in particular. So I'll let the poem hopefully stand on its own, and you can take from it what you will. But I know that I was definitely thinking about the refugee crisis when I wrote this poem. It's called The Capacity of Speech. It is easy to be decent to speechless things, to hang houses for the purple martins to nest in, to bed down the horses under the great white wing of the year's first snow, to ensure the dog and cat are comfortable, to set out suet for the backyard birds, to put the poorly shot, wounded deer down, to nurse its orphaned fawn until its spots are gone, to sweep the spider into the glass and tap it out into the grass, to blow out the candle and save the moth from flame, to trap the black bear and set it free, to throw the thrashing brook trout back. How easy it is to be decent to things that lack the capacity of speech, to feed and shelter whatever will never beg us or thank us or make us ashamed. So I just wanted to write a list of things that we do for creatures, for birds, for our pets, for even for a deer that has been shot, for a spider, for a moth, catching a trout, throwing it back, you know, pinching the barbed hooks down, even though I don't mention that in the poem. I mean, there are all these things that we do to lessen suffering. It's easy in a way to be decent to things that don't have the capacity to speak. That's why I called the poem The Capacity of Speech. We can feed and we can shelter these creatures because they don't have the ability to beg us for mercy or to thank us or to say something that might make us ashamed of ourselves. I feel like there's something about speechless things, things of you know, creatures that are in our world, but maybe that we feel some kind of superiority over, that allows us to treat them better than we do other human beings who can make us feel ashamed of ourselves, and therefore we turn cold and cruel towards them. There's a certain cruelty that happens amongst human beings that I don't think we see between humans and creatures. And so that's what I was trying to get at in the poem. I don't know if I s accomplished that successfully, but that's what I was trying to say. And then, because we're running short on time, I'm gonna share what's probably my favorite poem that I've written. And I don't know if there's any particular reason why it's my favorite. I feel like maybe it all harkens back to what I was saying before about being surprised. I was surprised by this poem, which is called Ode to Flour, Flour, the flour you bake with. I didn't really expect to write a poem. Actually, I remember writing this poem and just not even really giving it my whole effort, because I was I remember I was like heading out the door to go somewhere, and just this thought came to me, and I was just like literally standing at my desk jotting it down, and then the poem kind of took kind of got some momentum, and it started building some momentum, and I finished it. And so I remember feeling like it had been this poem that very, very well could not have could have not existed. And so it has always felt to me like kind of a poem that I caught, like it could have snuck away from me, but I was able to just catch it in time, which maybe is one of the reasons that I like it so much. There's something kind of tenuous about this one. So again, it's called Ode to Flour, and I'll read it, and then I'll just say a few last words, and then again, unfortunately, say farewell for now. Ode to Flour. I was feeling down and wanted to praise something harmless, something we don't necessarily need, but that I'm glad we have, and I lit just now upon flour. I suppose flour could be harmful if you don't eat wheat, but let's assume you do. Think, where did your mother keep the flour when you were a child? Or your father? Perhaps it was your father who did the baking. Maybe neither your mother nor your father baked, but they still kept some flour around, left over from Christmas, or because a neighbor had brought some over. Though why a neighbor would bring flour over and then leave without it, I don't know. Anyway, you can tell I want there to have been flour in your childhood kitchen, in a paper bag that gave off a little gasp of powder every time it was opened, which wasn't often. On the side of the bag, a girl in a dress tiptoed amongst hens, a wicker basket on her arm, and it was understood she was bringing bread to the sick and poor. Or maybe your family stored the flour in a glass jar with a wire lid that latched, or in a stoneware canister with the word flour painted in blue cursive on the side. Wherever it was, maybe you reached your hand inside every now and then to wonder at how something so dry could feel so cool that it felt damp. Or maybe this is the wrong poem for you. Maybe you loved salt. So that was Ode to Flour, the last poem that I'm going to share today. And I think I really just wanted to write an ode, which is a celebratory poem. I wanted to celebrate something kind of simple and something we might overlook on a day-to-day basis. And maybe that's a good place to conclude Poet's Table for now, to say that, poetry awakens in us wonderment and appreciation and gratitude for small things. And I hope that even in just the half hour that I've hosted this show on Friday mornings, you've connected with some particular poem or line or image in a way that has made your day feel fuller and richer, and has brought some light into your life in some way. And if I've done that, then I'm really happy and really glad to have been able to host this show. And again, I'm so appreciative to all of you for listening and for being there on these Friday mornings as I share with you some of my favorite poets and poems. So with that, I'm going to sign off for now. As I said at the beginning of the show, this will be the last Poets Table for a while. But I wish you all well, and I hope that you have a wonderful winter, and I hope that you continue to read and resonate with poems in your own time. And I want to thank you one last time for listening to Poets Table. Again, I'm Austin Smith. I've been your host, and you've been listening to WDRT out of Viroqua. Thank you, everyone, and take care.